This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears and I'm joined as always by Bradley Chambers. Tonight we have two sponsors for the show. Welcome back our friends from Jam Software, makers of the Casper Suite. And we have a new sponsor we've picked up this week, Aerohive Networks, frequently mentioned on the show. They've come along to sponsor a few episodes as well. So it's great to have those pair on board with us. Bradley, quiet week?
Big week, I guess.
Yeah.
Expensive week, I guess, for you and possibly for me. Mm-hmm. So, no, it's a very exciting week. It's always, you know, it's almost like a slow ride up to these announcements, and then it's very exciting, and then it's like just the onslaught of the news, but then also the analysis afterwards. And, you know, we kind of in this announcement hit really all cylinders of Apple's product line. And that, of course, directly affects what we do and our planning going forward. And so it'll be fun to get into.
Yeah, I think that there's always the what happened analysis, which is just the story of the day. And then there's some deeper analysis happens, you know, very quickly afterwards. And then over the longer period as to what really just happened there, you know, not just what did they say, but what are the implications of that? And I guess tonight what we're going to do is just try and talk about what happened. And some of the initial thoughts about that. I mean, I've been traveling all week with my daughter. We're down in London this week, so I've been desperately trying to download Keynote over cellular to try and check out what it can do. So I've managed to have a little play with some of the apps, but certainly not all of them, and none of the Mac versions yet either. So it'll be interesting to have a chat about some of that as well. So where do you want to start, Bradley?
I guess we'll start with the Mavericks upgrade. That it was free, and really just something about Mavericks, and we'll talk about that. Of course, if you've been under a rock, that Apple has announced that Mavericks is available. It is for a free upgrade rather than the $29 or $19 they've done in years past. So it's pretty funny that I spent more on purchasing John Siracusa's 24,000-word review of Mavericks than did on Mavericks. Hmm.
Yeah, it's interesting that I think it feels that they've been working up to this for a number of years. You know, I mean, what did we pay for Panther? Like $129?
Yes, then Tiger. Yeah, Tiger was the first one I bought standalone, and I paid $129 for it.
Yep, and then Leopard was about the same price, and then Snow Leopard got cheaper, and then, you know, they've just been driving down towards free for a long time. So it's not really a surprise that happened, I don't think. I wonder what the impact of that is going to be.
You know, there was, you know, you get two aspects of that. You've got the financial aspect, and then you've got really the users and developers aspect. And I think I read on a Simco where he estimates this will be about a $450 million kind of revenue hit on for Apple. But again, I think the idea behind their idea is to sell more hardware, and you know, certainly with, we'll talk about iLife and iWork as well included in that dollar amount, but you know, for me, it was interesting. Like I hadn't really talked to our staff about Mavericks yet. Our first quarter ended basically, I guess, a week or so ago. And so I've been working on report cards. And so really, you know, that's all I've been doing work wise. Cause it's not a manual process, but different classes grade things differently. And so like there's some grades in certain classes have number grades and some are letter grades, and I always forget, and because I do it four times a year, so I always screw it up somehow. And so like I had one teacher come down and she said, hey, upgrade to Mavericks, it's really cool. And I thought, huh, like she had no idea about it. I mean, because she has an iPhone and she, you know, understands like upgrading to iOS 7 and things like that, so she's a more savvy teacher. And thankfully I'd been testing some of our applications, particularly like the Promethean driver. Thankfully it's still compatible. Mm-hmm. We've had issues with that in the past. And she said it seems really cool. I like, you know, some of the new interface tweaks and things like that. And it's interesting that she just did it. And I wonder, cause I encourage our teachers to always, you know, run your updates and keep it up to date and things like that. But it's interesting. And I'm wondering if like the ease of install for say iOS 7, iOS 6 is teaching people that it's not as big of a deal to upgrade, and you know, these more incremental upgrades, you know, it's like it's not such a drastic change.
Yeah, I mean, I think always when you don't charge people money for it, it's much easier to get people to do it. And I think the difference between free and not free is much greater than the difference between $13 and $20 or $13 and $50 or whatever. But you know, there's so many people who have come to Apple platforms from iOS who have been conditioned their entire Apple experience life to pay zero for a software upgrade and just to install it whenever it arrives. And I guess what they're trying to do is they're trying to get that same culture around the Mac that there is around iOS. And it's been interesting just traveling since iOS 7 came out, looking over the shoulder of people using iPhones and iPads on the tube or in airports. The proportion of them running iOS 7 is substantial. And it's quite surprising now when you see somebody who's using an iOS device that's not running iOS 7. It seems the vast majority of just the general public have hit that button already. And I think also with something like Mavericks in particular, it's harder for me to explain to people why they should spend money on that. And I think it's become such a kind of mature product now that it's not easy to say, well, you know, the calendar looks a bit different and something about power management, which just sounds like blah, blah, blah to people who aren't particularly technically savvy. So I think it's also the consequence of a more mature product that it's harder. But again, you know, $450 million, that's change to Apple, right? You know, they don't need the money anymore. I think the Apple of 2001, 2002, 2003 really needed the money from software upgrades, whereas the Apple today just doesn't need that money. So that's also part of the deal as well, I think.
Yeah, I was talking to a guy at work today, and he had upgraded his home computer, and he said, "Hey, you know, like I really like the Mac and Apple, and I read some reviews of it, and they seemed positive. But I tried to read some kind of like non-positive reviews of it to see what people like criticisms, and I said it's kind of hard to criticize an upgrade that is free. I said, you know, it's not. I said you're not going to see like these drastic changes on the Mac. It's a very mature product." And I was like you, and people would say, "Hey, you know, even Snow Leopard. Say, hey, I'm on Snow Leopard. Should I upgrade?" It's like, well, what do you do? It's like, well, I mainly get on the internet, and my email's in Gmail. I do some stuff in office, and it's hard to convince people, you know. But thinking back to like say the Tiger days, it's like, all right, Tiger to Leopard. Like, what do you get Leopard? They had, you know, Time Machine was added, and all sorts of great features that like you really wanted people to upgrade for, and it's just more of a slow refinement on the Mac and like kind of continue to tighten the belt. And, you know, Macs that we have Mountain Lion, and I would probably not have upgraded them to Mavericks, had it cost money, but I certainly will now. So I estimate like this will save me about $2,000 ultimately, like if I were to have paid for it, based on kind of the previous pricing. But if you just, you know, kind of going back to our discussion, like what's the noticeable impact functionality wise in the classroom and, you know, for a teacher and a student? Like if I upgraded every computer we had overnight, and if I took, maps and iBooks off of the dock, like would they realistically notice?
Yeah. Yeah. I suppose not is the answer to that. Certainly not if they're running something more recent. I suppose maybe, you know, the increased interaction with multiple desktops and Apple TV might be something that they could use, but I think that's, you know, that's getting into a particular subset of all teachers who might think about using something like that. So it's, again, it's hard to sell these more incremental upgrades. And I'm not trying to do down Mavericks, because I think there are some things in there that are genuinely really important for the future of the Mac, in particular a lot of the power management stuff. But I think, you know, unless you have one of the more recent MacBooks or MacBook Airs as well, you're not really going to see a game-changing amount of battery life change when you go from one operating system to the other. You might see an hour or more, a couple hours more, but it's not going to be the difference between taking your charger and not taking your charger. Now, if you moved up to a brand new MacBook Air at the same time, I think that's a whole different story, because there you will see, you know, not life-changing is putting it too strongly, but certainly behavior-changing amounts of battery life improvement if you go for Mavericks and the new hardware at the same time.
Yeah, I agree. It's not that I think Mavericks is a bad release or a minor release. I think it's great, but it's like when you're talking to someone that doesn't care about some of the inner workings of the battery power management, it's hard to say, like, Finder has tabs. Well, they'll say, what's the Finder? You know, Finder has tags. What are tags? And again, these are things that, I mean, again, they pitched it as a is a release about kind of improving usability, you know, in terms of these power management things, and also for power users. And a lot of things, like my boss, for example, is not, he likes technology, not really a tech savvy person, you know, like I would consider myself, mm-hmm. but he does use dual display and he loves it. Like, and people at our office that use dual displays that have upgraded love that aspect of it because I think that's highly functional. And it's again, that's a power user feature. Our teachers yeah. don't have dual displays in the classroom, but so not a bad release, but again, it's free. I mean, it's hard to complain. It works well. I haven't heard any, horror stories about upgrading and, you know, I'll probably over the next few months upgrade our staff. You know, I've got some, well, one of the things that I'm fighting right now is I don't know if you're aware of the recall on the MacBook Airs. It's specifically mm-hmm. the model that we have. Majority of our staff. So,
okay.
Thankfully I have tested three so far and they've not even asked me to run the firmware upgrade. And so mm-hmm. that means if it's not even testing for it, that means they're not affected at all. So I'm hoping that maybe our batch, like, wasn't even one of the ones. Maybe it's like a certain model of flash memory that they detected mm-hmm. to be bad. And it's not even that if it tests it, it's going to be bad. Like it tries to apply a firmware update. And if it's not able to fix it, then it tells you basically to take it in. And so my plan is to kind of go hit each of our classrooms, one by one, make sure they're all updated on software update, run that test if it asks for it. And if it doesn't, go ahead and upgrade it to Mavericks and be done with it. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is reading the documentation on Apple's website, I'm not seeing where I can replace those MacBook Airs, the flash memory. From what I'm seeing, it wants you to take it to an Apple authorized retailer. It doesn't even talk about self-servicing accounts like we are. So, it's going to be tricky if it doesn't appear that I'm going to be able to fix it. And so I've got, thankfully, a couple spare laptops that we always buy just for this purpose. And I will, over Thunderbolt, migrate their data, you know, give it to them. Hey, this is your new computer. Thankfully, my spares don't need to be upgraded or fixed. And then take those in, let them be repaired, and then kind of, you know, repeat that process until everybody is tested for that recall and is on Mavericks.
Yeah, it's kind of a shame that there's not a... There doesn't seem to be an obvious serial number check that you could do through Apple Remote Desktop. It seems to want to run this firmware update to check it. I mean, my MacBook Air was not affected because mine's got the 512 gigs upgrade SSD, and that was not part of the recall. I think it was only the 64 and the 128.
Yes, that's correct. So mine wasn't either.
Yeah. Yeah. So it didn't, again, same with you, it didn't ask me to even run the updater to check it, so...
So yeah, so if you got it, you know, it's the mid 2012 MacBook Air that was stopped being sold. I think it was like from September of 2012 to June of 2013. But from all the documentation I'm reading today, if it doesn't ask you to do the firmware upgrade, then it's certainly not affected. So
yeah, that seems to be the rule.
So yeah, but great upgrade. Highly recommend John Siracusa and Stephen Hackett's reviews. Stephen Hackett's comes in at about 9,000 words and John Siracusa's comes in at about 24,000. You know, Stephen Hackett's is obviously available on his website at 512pixels.net. And John Siracusa's is available at Ars Technica, but also on the Kindle store and the iBook store. I went with the iBooks version at $5.
Okay. I was holding out for the Kindle version just because I tend to buy all my ebook stuff in Kindle format these days. I think there was like a day's delay or something, so I haven't picked it up yet, but I'm going to try and get it for the train home tomorrow. Always good times to have a warm-up review before the real review.
That's true. Yeah, I really enjoyed Stephen Hackett's. And they kind of focus on different things. I mean, a lot of Stephen's is mm-hmm. about functionality, and a lot of John's goes into kind of like the nitty-gritty of the power management. But both are excellent. And if you can only pick one, I guess I'd pick Stephen's just because it's shorter, and maybe you'll finish it.
Yeah, I immediately regret calling out one of them as the real review. They're both obviously real reviews. It's just that one is substantially heavier than the other if you were to print it out.
One is like, you would look at one like the Book of Psalms, and the other one is the New Testament.
Yeah, or maybe the Old Testament, the way Siracusa brings it.
True, true. Before we move on, let's thank our first sponsor of the night. It's Aerohive Networks. You know, if you listen to the show, you know Frazier and I are big fans of Aerohive Networks. Talked to them about them in length on a past show. And just for disclosure, we were already in discussions with them before that show about sponsoring the show. So what they do is they reduce the cost and complexity of today's networks with cloud-managed Wi-Fi and switching and routing solutions for enterprise and, you know, medium-sized businesses, schools, branch offices, teleworkers, you know, they have products for everybody. Their award-winning cooperative control Wi-Fi architecture, you can run it in a public or private cloud-managed network, and they, again, do switching and routing solutions that are aimed at eliminating costly controllers and single points of failure. You know, that's one of the things that I love about Aerohive. There are no controllers. There's no cloud controller. They're just no controllers. All the APs are standalone, but you can see them all through a cloud-managed network management solution. Again, you can either do like a public cloud, which they host it, or you can host it on your own internal network in a VMware environment. This gives customers a mission-critical reliability, but you also have granular security and policy enforcement and the ability to start small and expand without limitations. So you can start out with 5 APs today, and you can move to 500 next week. So again, the same thing with switches. You can see all their products from basically one single pane of glass with the switching and the wireless. One of the things I love about Aerohive is all their products are running the same code base. They call it HiveOS. And so as they go forward, again, you know, security updates should be faster. You know, they can roll out feature releases faster, again, because they're in control of the code. They're not farming that out to some company overseas, in another country, that they are doing it themselves. So it's HiveOS. So, more information about Aerohive Networks, go to aerohive.com, or you can follow them on Twitter. It's at Aerohive. And also, if you're interested, they have webinars on, I think, a weekly basis, where if you qualify, you can actually get a free access point and a free Hive Manager online account, so you can test them out in your home. But again, that's aerohive.com or at Aerohive on Twitter. So thanks for Aerohive for sponsoring the show this week.
Yes, indeed. Thanks to them. So, next thing from the keynote.
Well, I guess let's talk about iWork and iLife.
Okay. Much to talk about. I think probably another show in the offing on that as well, once I've actually managed to download all of the apps, which is coming. What do you think? There's obviously two sides of this to talk about, I think, Bradley. One is the Mac side, and one is the iOS side. And of course, there's also this thing on the web.
You know, I don't use iWork and iLife as much as I maybe did in years past. I just don't do much in spreadsheets. I maybe open numbers a couple of times a month. Main thing I keep in there is our inventory for all of our computers. I just don't use Pages that much. I use Keynote, again, when I do presentations, don't use them a ton. The thing that immediately stood out about these upgrades are the unification of the file format. There was nothing more frustrating than opening up like a Keynote on your iPad and asking you to make a copy of it because it may not look the same. Mm-hmm. And I never understood why that was, but I guess the file formats were different, so it was making a copy of that. It's great that it's free. Those are great. You know, again, we've been using the same iWork since 2009 and the same iLife for 2011, so it's great that they're free with all new Macs. Just for reference, in the States, we pay about $52 for, like, Microsoft Office 2011 through the educational pricing. So it's certainly a lot cheaper.
Yeah, it certainly represents a saving there as well. I think you can look at it from an institutional point of view and you can say, well, that's going to save us a bunch of money, which it will, which is great. But from a consumer point of view as well, you now look at, if you walk out of an Apple store with an iOS device, you're walking out with an additional layer of capability that people who walk out of another store with another device don't have right off the bat. And in some cases, simply can't get. I mean, there's nothing like GarageBand for Android or Windows, for that matter. Windows RT. So it's interesting to me from that point of view. But I think the story that I took away from the whole Apple keynote was really that what they were sort of saying was that iPads are work tools and they are built and priced that way. And I think I could have used Apple being a bit more explicit about that. I thought they were not as aggressive as they probably could have been, and certainly I think not as aggressive as Steve Jobs would have been about exactly why you want this product and what it's for and who should get it and all the things you can do with it. Because I don't know what you thought, particularly the iLife and iWork section of the keynote, I thought they really glossed over a lot of stuff.
Yeah, they didn't.
Did you get a feeling of that?
Yeah, it's kind of like, this is some great stuff. We don't have time to show it all to you, but it's great. And they spent a lot of time on the collaboration, which in some ways felt a little awkward. And I've heard from...
I thought it felt really awkward.
It just was way too long. And that I've heard in, you know, since then that the collaboration is not as seamless as they made it out to be. It's kind of like if Google Docs is on version 10, this is version 1 of iWork. It's just not as seamless as working with Google Docs. But again, I think they needed to do the collaboration, needed that. The web, you know, it's great that they have free, you know, web interface, but... You know, I think you're right when you start, if you have a customer that's comparing various, you know, if we're comparing like an Android tablet and a Microsoft PC, or you're comparing like an iPad and a Mac, this is something that's just already built in. It's, I kind of look at it like, we do with iLife, you know, that it was just like built in. You don't need to buy any extra software to make movies or to manage your photos, or to make music. Like it's just built in. It's free. And, you know, smart move, I think, because it's giving customers, like when they're kind of doing the feature checklist, it's like built-in productivity software. I mean, does your Dell have built-in productivity software? Sometimes it does. Sometimes it's just a trial of Office and you have to pay, you know, either for the 365 subscription at $99 a year, you have to buy the student teacher edition of Office. And, you know, it's, again, going back to the Mavericks upgrade, this is all built around selling more hardware to people.
Yeah, I mean, I think Apple's strategy could not be more clear. That they want to give you a lot of stuff for free, but the price of that is that you buy new iPads, phones, Macs on a regular basis. I try and explain that to people when I do presentations where we talk about which platform should we get for a school. I'm always saying, look, these strategies are not very hard to work out. Apple sells computers, Amazon sells books, and Google sells your data. Right. And the fact that that's where all those three companies make their money. I say books and I mean by that everything they sell in the store. But that's how these three companies make their money. And the fact that of all the other things you get for free, with Google you get Android for free, with Apple you get iWork for free, with Amazon you get basically the tablet for, you know, not free but at cost, because all these companies are making their money other ways. And it's really, it's not hard to work out how these companies are making their money. So, I think it's a bit of a strategy credit for Apple that they get to give away these applications for free because they depend on the sales of the hardware. But I guess, you know, beyond the strategy questions, I guess my next concern is, are these apps any good? What have they really done to these apps to justify the 2.0 number on the iOS versions and the update on the Mac versions as well. I've only played so far with Keynote on iOS, and it seems to be, I mean, Keynote's the one that I care about the most because, frankly, it's how I pay my bills sometimes by using Keynote. But on the iOS version, and I've actually been using iOS, Keynote and iOS exclusively now for about, I'm trying to think, when's the last time I presented for my Mac? Probably almost a year ago now. It was the last time I took my Mac to do a presentation. I've been doing presentations off Keynote on iOS for about a year, and it's worked really, really well for me. It's been great. Obviously, when you use Keynote a lot, there's a lot of things that you might want them to add to it. And I think what I've found so far is that there have been additions to the Keynote for iOS, but many of them, they're not in the core of the app. So they're not, they haven't added, for example, layers to the presentation engine. They haven't done a lot with that. They have added some new transitions, some new themes, and obviously they've tuned the interface for iOS 7. But there isn't a lot of functional additions except in one particular area. And I think this is actually quite interesting and quite telling. What I found is that Keynote 2 in iOS supports a hyperlinks only mode of playback, which means that you can't advance or reverse the slides. All you can do is navigate through the deck by hyperlinks, which says to me, kiosk. At the same time, you can put a soundtrack on the background of your Keynote deck, and you can also set passwords, and you can set it to autoplay when it opens and so on. So it seems to me that there's a wee set of features have been put in to make it easier to use Keynote to drive iPad-powered kiosks. And I think it was quite interesting to discover that. I thought it was, I was looking through it going, where are all the new features? And then I found them. And I was like, oh, that looks like it's for one particular thing. And it clearly seems to be built around that, which is an interesting use case, but it's not everything I was kind of hoping for so far.
Well, and that's can lead to a lot of iPad sales ultimately. You know, those have a a museum buying 30 iPads for displays that can I don't know. And again, we use them internally for time clocks. We needed something that our time software runs on a web server, and so we needed something that was easy to use and inexpensive. And if you start looking at, well, do we really need to buy like a laptop when all they're doing is literally clocking in and out? And so iPads were cheaper ultimately, and so we bought a couple of them. And you do that times a lot of museums and various places that might do that. That's a neat use case, certainly. And I wonder, we could spend a whole show on this, but you just wonder, like, 6 months from now, like, what do these apps look like? Like, we get these ready? We were really rushed getting these ready. What do these look like in 6 months? Because, one of the other things we saw was Find My iPhone was updated. The podcast app was updated. One of the things that didn't see an update was iBooks. If you look at like the Mac version, it looks drastically different. It doesn't have the bookshelf, the skeuomorphic bookshelf that, Delicious Library was so famous for, like it does on the iPhone and the iPad. So you wonder, like, did they literally just get these done? Like, they had to pay the guys from the app review team with, pizza for they would approve them. Mm-hmm. And so you just wonder, I'm reminded in some ways of the Final Cut when it came out, it was so many, missing features. And over the past couple of years, they've added all those back. They kind of built a new foundation that this is what we want. We got a unified file format. This is what we think the next generation of presentation software looks like. Okay. I know we're missing some things. We will add those back. We will rebuild this stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think the thing that sort of saved the Final Cut transition to Final Cut 10 was that they came out and said so. Quite shortly after the release, they said, look, we know that it's not got everything you want. We're going to work on it. And I think if they come out and say that about iWork, I think that, or iLife, that'll be welcome as well. I think my biggest concern with what's happened is that it appears that some of the Mac versions have gone backwards in their functionality. And not only that, because that's the keynote, the Final Cut Pro scenario, which, we can live with that for a while, I think. But my concern right now is that there are some file features that were possible on iWork 09 that are not possible on iWork 13. And what's happening is that when you open those documents in the new version, they're being upgraded to the new file format, and whatever isn't supported in the new file format is just being thrown away. And it seems to me that I've heard complaints about it with Pages, that certain things like images in the headers and images filling table cells are two features I've heard of today that are not supported in the new file format and are just being wiped out by dint of opening the files in the new version of Pages, which is really, really not okay if that's happening. And I'm concerned about that now because I have, several keynote decks that really I use very intensely, and they've been worked on for a long time, and I want to make sure I can upgrade them without damage. So I am slightly concerned about that. I've heard some complaints on Keynote about certain video file formats not being supported, but I think what I'll do is we'll test that over the course of next week and maybe talk about it on the next show as well. But if that's happening, that is a real concern. It's not just that, there's a button here missing or a button there, or, the word count doesn't work the same way anymore. But if it's actually wiping out people's data, that is a matter of some concern.
I guess the strategy there, knowing that's a reality, because when you upgrade, all of these apps stay on your computer, like the iWork 09 apps stay on your computer as well. Same thing with iLife. So
yeah.
I guess the way to do it would be to keep those around and all your documents, make copies of them, and then open the copies and the new ones and see what works, see what doesn't. Again, shouldn't work that way, but that should be your strategy going forward. I guess the way Apple probably should have done this is detected that upon launch in very much the same way that, like, if you open, like an Excel document in Keynote, that it detects what is not compatible and lets you know. And so you can go fix that.
Yeah.
But it doesn't do that. So that's not good.
Yeah. I think what I've seen I've been working with Keynote on iOS so far. What I see is that my older version documents, it says, If you continue to open this file, it will only be compatible with this version of Keynote and the Keynote for Mavericks on the Mac. And it gives you the option to back out of that and cancel or open a copy as well, which is great. But the problem being, if you've gone to all the 2.0 versions on your iOS devices and you want to stick with Keynote 09 on the Mac, then you're going to have a problem because those file formats are not going to be at all compatible anymore. Not even like fractionally compatible like they were in the previous situation. So a little more testing is required on that, I think. What I do see, though, as far as I can tell, is that say you've got documents you made on the iOS version of iWork, the 1.4 version that we've had for a few years now. It seems to me that the 2.0 apps and the new file format is a strict upgrade from what used to be possible in iOS. So if you have Pages documents or Keynote documents that were made on iOS and only ever used in iOS, then as you upgrade to the new apps, they will be smoothly upgraded. That's my sense so far. I haven't extensively tested that, but I think that's true, which is great for us because for our kids, all their documents have only been made on the iOS versions of these apps. And if they can get a smooth upgrade path, that will be really helpful. But for people who've got documents from the Mac as well, that's more tricky. So, and I'd love to know the story behind this. You know, what was wrong with Keynote and Pages 09 that requires a ground up rewrite? What was it about the file format that wasn't working for people? I'm not sure. Maybe it was hard to diff it for iCloud syncing or something. I'm not sure. But I'd love to know the story if somebody wants to email us. We'll keep it off the show. Okay, Bradley, do you want to talk about the hardware? So why don't we just lay out what happened and then we'll get into the details of it. So what happened was the existing iPad was discontinued. The fourth generation iPad was discontinued and replaced with something they're calling the iPad Air, which essentially takes the design cues from the iPad Mini with the thin left and right bezels, the slightly more rounded shell, lightning connector, and so on. and that is available in all the same price points and all the same configurations as before. So 16, 32, 64, and 128 gigs, LTE and Wi-Fi only. Two different versions. So no change in the prices, no change in the configurations. But what's inside that device is an A7 processor, an M7 processor, which is actually something that surprised me a little bit. But I'm just assuming that what that means is you can't get an A7 without an M7. I'm assuming they're on the same chip. No Touch ID, much to my disappointment. And an improvement in the Wi-Fi radios to support 2x2 MIMO as well. So that was what happened with the big iPad. Also, they dropped 0.4 pounds off the weight, which is incredible. So it weighs just under 1 pound now. It's a massive weight saving on that device. And what they've done is they've taken basically that entire machine and made that the Retina Mini smaller. So there is no, as far as we know, there's no hardware distinction at all between the full-size iPad, either iPad Air they're calling it, and the Retina iPad Mini. So both of them have A7, both of them has M7, both of them have MIMO radios, slightly improved cameras, and they're running really fast. And apparently they're clocked at the same speed as well, is what I'm hearing. At the same time that, the non-Retina iPad Mini lives on in a 16GB only configuration, but available Wi-Fi or LTE at that level. And they've knocked a few dollars off the price as well. So it's a little bit cheaper, but it's not available in the broad range of configurations as well. Other interesting point to say about the Retina iPad Mini is there's now a 128GB version of that as well. And that's new. That wasn't possible for the Mini before, I don't think. And doubly bizarrely, the iPad 2 lives on. It's the zombie iPad that will not die. I think I have a theory as to why that is, Bradley, if you'd like to hear it.
Yeah, you know, it's a strange thing because you're realistically, they are both running A5s, but to me it would have made more sense, I guess, from the product perspective to kill the iPad 2 and just leave the iPad Mini hanging around at $299 for the price tag. So you've got this full-size iPad that's, you know, $399. It's strange that the price didn't drop. I would love to have seen that drop to $299. So you could either pick a full-size or a Mini at $299. Mm-hmm. But you know, we talked, I believe, on Twitter of, you know, is this really aimed at education, and this is, should this really just be an education only SKU? But then again, you know, going back to our discussion of, you know, kiosk and time clocks and things like that, that doesn't matter for maybe the bigger screen size matter, but doesn't matter about performance. And so maybe it does have uses beyond education. You know, I guess the real frustration is the dock connector lives on another year.
Yeah.
But, you know, this, you know, from a developer's perspective, I don't think it's as big a deal because the mini is hanging around and those are only a year old. So I think realistically, the developers are going to have to support the i5 for a couple more years anyways.
Yeah, that was always going to happen because of the iPad mini from last year. So I think, you know, it doesn't make much of a difference for the platform yet, but my theory about why it was kept around is partly because, you know, the 16 gig Retina iPad mini and the iPad 2 are the same price, right? They're $399. Am I right?
Yes.
I think that's right. Yeah. So you might ask, well, why couldn't Apple just say, well, if you've got $399 to spend on an iPad, just go and get an entry level Retina mini to schools or anybody else interested. And I think the reason that they can't say that is because in some states they have their standardized testing regime, and over the past couple of years that has been slowly moving towards being computer-based testing. Furthermore, I know this was controversial about a year or so ago, many states, I think New York was one, but there were others, said initially that their minimum spec for a computer that you could do a standardized test on was a 10-inch screen. And the iPad, being at 9.7 inches, was excluded from that list, but a lot of schools wanted to use it. So everybody lobbied for the screen, the minimum screen size to be reduced to 9.7 inches exactly, just so you could use an iPad. And the reason then that you couldn't say, well, just get yourself a mini if you've got that money to spend, is because the mini is obviously less than 9.7, and I don't think anybody can face going through another round of lobbying to try and get the standardized test minimum screen size down to a smaller number again. I don't think that would fly even if people tried it. But that's my theory as to why the iPad 2 sticks around. Is partly its appeal in education is really to line up with regulations rather than because it's the device people want. I think it's sufficiently old-fashioned now. I mean, obviously not supporting AirDrop is a really big deal, and also having such poor cameras is a really big deal. But if you mainly want them as a suite of test computers, then who cares about those features? And I think basically, you know, Apple might just be looking at that and saying, well, let's take as much margin as we can and give them the cheapest one to build for that. And I think you're right, though, that there's also other applications for a cheaper but big iPad that's not just purely education. But I think the education angle is primarily about testing rather than about the desirability of that device in the classroom, because I really believe that if I had only $399 to spend on an iPad, you'd be much better served getting a Retina Mini because of its modern interior and A7 processor and so on than getting a bigger one just because it's bigger, but taking all the limitations of the iPad 2 along with it.
Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly with you. I think Apple does have some education-specific SKUs, and I know in the U.S. store, I believe there's like an education-only iMac that you can buy that's a little underpowered. I think it actually has an i3 processor. Okay. It may only have 2 gigs of RAM, so they certainly still do education-only SKUs. But, you know, again, and obviously people were buying them still, and that's the reason they held them in the store. And they must still think it's going to sell going forward. And you know, I think you're probably right on those standardized testing. Apple doesn't want to miss that piece of that pie.
Yeah, for sure. Because I think if you can't use a particular computer for standardized testing, you're probably not going to use it at all.
Right.
And what will happen is those schools will just go Chromebook all the way, because you can do your testing in a Chromebook, and as we know, testing is the most important part of education, and everything else just kind of takes whatever the tests say. So
it's there to support the test.
Yeah. It's very important for Apple to be in that mix as well. What else did you see in the hardware that you thought was interesting, Bradley?
You know, the new radio on the Wi-Fi obviously was intriguing to me. I will be definitely interested to see the performance impact. I may or may not be buying a new iPad. I have not made up my mind yet. And then if I do, I will probably buy the mini. So I'll probably wait a few weeks until those are released because those are for late November. But I'll be really be interested in seeing what the testing is like in just real world. Can I tell a difference? Number one, and does the data, you know, can I tell a difference? Like maybe in our office. Of course, no 11AC. That was a surprise to some people, but I didn't expect it to because I expected that in the iPhone first. So I think we'll wait another year before Editor 11AC is in the product line. Now it's in outside of the Mac Mini and the non-Retina MacBook Pro. The Mac lineup is 11AC all the way. Was the announcement from the MacBook Pro and Retina model and the Mac Pro, which we'll talk about later. They are all 11AC, but you know, 16 gigabyte is still the baseline, which makes me quite sad. It's just at some point you just think like they can't buy those chips anymore. Like they'll just come in 32. That'll be the stock size.
Yeah, you would think so. And I mean, I said on Twitter today, I deal with the I don't have any more space on my device problem, possibly 20 times more frequently than any other problem on iOS. And it's fascinating to me that it's not what you would think of as power users who are hitting this problem now. It's everybody. And I mean, walking around London the past couple of days, you know, Beth and I have seen people just shooting photo with their tablets, shooting video with their tablets everywhere. It was Prince George's christening yesterday, so we went to Buckingham Palace, saw the soldiers going past and the guards and everything. And the number of people shooting videos on iPad tablets there was phenomenal and surprising to me as well. But, you know, those people, if they're carrying a 16 gig, they're filling that up pretty fast. You know, a day out in London, that's your device full. No question about it. So yeah, we've talked for, you know, maybe a year now that nobody should really be buying 16 gigs, unless, of course, they're buying those devices for very specific applications. But I think there's a small group of people who buy a 16 gig device because they know that that is all they need. But the majority of 16 gig buyers, I think, are buying it because it's the cheapest one. And then they regret it pretty quickly afterwards, particularly if they're buying it for games or entertainment or anything like that. So I had hoped to see them change that, but I guess you've got to keep the margin up wherever you can.
I mean, what is it going to cost him to go to 32? Like, it's got to be dollars on the cost.
Yeah. Yep. But one point on the margin, maybe two.
Yeah. So, but yeah, great upgrade. So are you getting a new iPad?
I am absolutely getting a new iPad. I'm planning to go for a 64 gig LTE iPad Air. Maybe even in white. Although I'm not sure about that yet. I haven't decided that part. I may also go for the 128 just because we're doing more video stuff at school now. And the cost difference is what, maybe £70. And, you know, the cost to change if I ever needed that would be much more, given that 64 gigs is pretty much my minimum size iPad right now anyway, that I might even go for 128. But the nice thing about wanting such a big iPad, it's easy to get one on the first day because nobody wants to buy that one. Everybody's buying the 32 gig Wi-Fi model. That's the one that most people get anyway. So that's my plan, and I'm hopefully going to get it day one if I can. It looks like a really nice upgrade, and I think the big thing is going to be the weight drop on that device, because I was concerned that if they take, you know, the reason that the full-size iPad has such wide bezels is because it's heavy, right? And if the device is heavy and you want to one-hand it, you need to have a substantial space on the front of the device to leverage your thumb against to hold it up. But if you cut the weight of the device, you can then start to cut the amount of leverage space you have on the sides as well. And that's been obviously true with the iPad Mini for a while, but I think you could only have done the iPad Mini outline on the full-size iPad if you also cut the weight as well. And I think what I'm looking for is, I'd be interested to see if there are, obviously new cases are going to be required, but if people start to bring out cases that preserve that lightness and slimness, because I know from buying a couple of iPad Mini cases that it's quite easy to destroy all the weight and size advantages of the iPad Mini quite quickly when you put it in a big chunky case. So I think people are going to have to start designing cases like that for the full size iPad as well.
Yeah, we'll see. A good update. Yeah. I heard some grumblings. That was not an exciting announcement, but I think if you just look at Apple, that's their MO at this point, is it's continual improvements. that maybe year to year over year don't seem like huge jumps, but like if you compare, like, say again, the iPad 2 to this iPad and how many years it's been, we've come a long way.
Mm-hmm. It's certainly true. I mean, I think some people have commented saying that, well, if there's an iPad Air, does that mean there's an iPad Pro coming? I'm not sure I buy that as a direct consequence of the naming scheme. But I think what, you know, one of the reasons for calling it Air was to get people away from the idea that big iPad equals fat and heavy iPad, which is what it was in most people's minds, was, oh, the big iPad, so heavy, I can't even hold it up for a minute because my forearms are so weak. And I think, you know, the fact that you have to say Air every time you refer to it now means that people are going to start to think of it like the MacBook Air as a thin and light thing. But I suppose it is possible that in principle one could imagine there being something a bit more like a Surface in terms of, you know, maybe two screens at once or something like that, larger screen as well, coming out in the future. I'd be very interested to see that, but I think that's at least a year away, if not 2 years away. So it doesn't, the possibility of that doesn't impact my thinking right now, but in the future it would be very interesting to see if Apple had the nerve to try and carve off a slice of the MacBook Air market and turn those people into iPad-only users. That's the question I've been asking for about 6 months now, is does somebody at Apple have the vision to make that happen? And it will require software changes in iOS. It may require new hardware as well, maybe bigger hardware. But I think that would be a fascinating future if somebody could put that together and build it.
No, I agree.
So speaking of MacBooks and Airs and Pros, there was a little tweak to some of those things as well.
Yeah. Before we talk about those, let's thank our last sponsor of the day, Jamp Software. Mm-hmm. We've been talking about them for a few months now. I actually had lunch with a director of operations from a neighboring school and talked actually a lot about both of our sponsors, Aerohive and Jamp. Naturally, when you're talking about iPad deployments, you know, things like Wi-Fi and MDM come up. So Jamp Software provides ICT staff with enterprise tools that power widespread use of Apple technology such as Macs, iPads, iPhones, and Apple TVs in education organizations. Again, with Casper Focus, which, again, all this is compatible with iOS 7, a day one support for iOS 7. Casper Focus, they have placed these powerful technologies directly into the hands of the teachers that work with students every day. Casper Focus allows the teachers, not the IT staff, to quickly gain students' attentions. They can conduct secure exams, they can select specific Apple TVs assigned to the class, and they can choose and distribute iBooks. And they can actually even initiate AirPlay right from within Casper Focus. So again, if you work with Apple products in the enterprise, this is the company you want to work with. It's Jamp Software. You can learn more at jampsoftware.com, and we'll have links to both of our sponsors on outofschool.net. So thanks to Jamp for sponsoring the show this week.
Yes, indeed.
So MacBook Pro, I actually ordered one of these today for a new new employee. It was actually one of these. It's a new video person. So I actually maxed one out. Everything you could get, it was on it. So so my first question is not even relating to the MacBook Pro, but why does the non-Retina live on? Because you know, they've got the 13-inch Retina down to $1,299. Of course, I don't love that model because it only has 128 gigabyte of storage. But again, there's an entry-level computer there. So why does that non-Retina live on?
Am I right that they've only got the 13-inch non-Retina model now? The 15-inch Retina model is non-Retina model is gone. Yeah, so there's only one non-Retina MacBook Pro now, which is a 13-inch model. I don't know. I guess there may be some people who still want a hard drive and an optical drive and are willing to put up with non-Retina display to get that. Doesn't seem like a deal to me, but I think, I guess, if you are on a tight budget and you need 500 gigs of storage, then putting a 512 SSD into a MacBook Pro with a Retina display is not really within your budget. So I guess that's the only reason for now. It seems to me the only reason why one would choose that over any of the more modern ones.
Yeah, I could see it staying around until the baseline Retina can either get down to maybe $11.99, or it comes stock with like a 256 gig flash memory stick.
Yeah, I think you need to have an option at that kind of entry level price that has a pretty fat hard drive on it. Because, I mean, at its simplest, people who like movies, right? And want to have a lot of movies on the laptop. You know, 128 gig SSD is not going to fly for those people either. Big music library, want to use a little bit of Final Cut Pro. Because the thing is now, all of these machines are so powerful that you can do that. There's no processor problem, there's no bus problem, there's no, well, there's not much of a video graphics problem for most of them either. So I think you, what you're looking for is another order of magnitude cut in the price of SSD before everybody under any circumstances can afford enough SSD to get their jobs done, whatever their jobs are. So I guess it's still just a timing thing for now, is my guess. And it's really more about the storage than about the display as well. So, do you want to talk about the new machines? What happened with the bumps?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So, what did we get? We got basically the faster chips with the better battery life in the bigger machines. Am I right?
Yes.
That's more or less it. Yeah. Seems great. I mean, who's, it's like democracy and freedom, who's going to complain about those things? But I think one of the interesting stories about the whole Mavericks generation of machines, and obviously the MacBook Airs before it, is that essentially what you're kind of seeing with Mavericks is you're seeing OS X become a mobile operating system. And the focus on things like battery life and resource efficiency with things like the compressed memory that they have in Mavericks as well. A lot of that's to do with mobile devices, laptops. And of course we know that, you know, Apple's sales are, I think, what was the last thing I heard? Maybe 70%, 75% of all Macs sold are portable devices in some way. So it makes a lot of sense to try and make that transition.
It's mind blowing to me.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, what's mind blowing as well is if you think about the Mac Pro that was announced, how many people are actually going to buy that? I mean, it's got to be in the single digit percentages of all Mac buyers. And if you think about it in terms of all Apple customers, it absolutely is in the single digit percentages, because the proportion who are buying Macs, and then the proportion of Mac users who are buying desktops, and then the proportion of Mac users buying desktops who are buying the Mac Pro, it's almost hard to believe that the machine was built.
Yeah, it's almost like a concept car. Like, we could do this in the future. Again, if for high-end video editing, for movie studios, you know, then that's where the situations where you can really have an ROI on a computer like that. Because if you can estimate that it's going to speed up rendering by X times, and you don't have to pay, I got to sit there while it renders, well, then there can be a true ROI on that. But I agree, it's not the, we will never buy one of those.
I wonder if I'll ever even see one. I mean, it seems to me a distinct possibility that I might never actually see a Mac Pro in use by anybody ever again. It seems weird to say that, but I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that nobody will buy it or nobody will ever use it, but I think the people who will use it are people who are billing someone else for every hour that machine's turned on.
Yeah, no, I agree. I would love to play with one, but I could never see myself buying that one, because again, it almost like removes some of the things that we loved about the old Mac Pro, the expandability, the, you know, multiple hard drives. It's, yeah. I mean, again, it's fast, but I know for me, like if I needed a really fast desktop Mac for the money, I would get an iMac. But again, if I feel that way, then I'm definitely not the target market for the Mac Pro.
Yeah, and in some ways, it's good that they've shed themselves of that constraint of trying to satisfy the prosumer as well, because I think what it's done is it's given you a very focused computer on a particular set of tasks. So if you render in Final Cut Pro 10, or you run Aperture, or finally Aperture might be fast, but also, you know, if you're doing Xcode, for example, if you're a developer, then yeah, I can see that, because increased CPU and disk speeds directly translate into more work done every day. Whereas for me, I wouldn't see that difference. You know, I mean, I'm doing plenty of work on devices much, you know, thousands of times slower in terms of I/O bandwidth and CPU performance in the form of my iPad. And I'm much more interested in that world now than I am in the extreme high-end computing world. Although it's great. I love that it exists. And I'm sure that things that they learn there will trickle down to many other products that they make over time. And I guess that's part of the reason for making it as well.
Yeah. Of course, my question, I guess, you know, thinking about these laptops is if you were building a one-to-one laptop program, would you mm-hmm. recommend a MacBook Air or a Retina MacBook Pro?
That's an interesting question, because if you look at the same price point, if you look at the price point of the entry level Retina MacBook Pro, which price, I think it's $1,299, am I right?
Yes.
Yeah, for that price, you're getting a 2.4 gigahertz processor, 128 gig storage, and a 9 hour battery, 4 gigs of RAM. Whereas for that same price, you're basically getting the most loaded MacBook Air. Not the most loaded you can build, but the most loaded stock configuration, which is the 1.3 gigahertz Haswell processor that boosts up to 2.5 if you need it, 256 gigs of SSD, and a 12-hour battery for the same price. So I think, to me, the question is whether or not, if it's a pure one-to-one program, I would be going with the MacBook Air, because what that does for you is it gives you more storage on the device. And in a one-to-one program, that's your primary storage, is the device storage. Whereas if you're talking about building a shared laptop deployment, and where you have a data infrastructure that lets you take the data and take it off the device and store it on a server somewhere, then you could probably get away with the Retina MacBook Pro. But again, the question is, if you're constraining your machine's performance by shoveling all its data off to a server live, then do you really need the faster computer in the first place? That's the question.
Yeah. Of course, the MacBook Pros also saw the 802.11ac upgrade as well, as we alluded to earlier.
Yes. Yeah. So I suppose there's a couple of things. If you needed the additional ports as well, if having a native HDMI port on the side was important to you, then of course there might be small things that swing the balance either way. But if I was doing a one-to-one laptop deployment, I would be going with the MacBook Air. And probably saving a bit of money, actually, as well, because I don't think I'd be going for the high-end 13-inch MacBook Air either.
Yeah, I think I would recommend the same.
Yeah. It would be nice to be in such a situation, wouldn't it?
Yeah, like an open... All right, just build what you want.
Yeah.
Build any computer you want. Everybody gets 1 terabyte flash memory. Yeah, that was one of the options. That's the first time I've seen that, is a 1 terabyte. And the high-end Retina MacBook Pro stock is 512. But you can do like a $450 upgrade to 1 terabyte, which...
So wow. They finally got to that level. Yeah, because yes. the previous max was 768, I think.
Yes.
Yeah. Soon this will all be over.
Yes.
It's been a bit of a painful transition, I think. It's been an interesting time because, you know, when the first MacBook Airs came out and they had an SSD option, and it was astronomically expensive and tiny. You know, it's like 64 gigs SSD or something, but it was like an £800 upgrade on that machine, if I remember right, to the point where the majority of people are now on SSD. And I don't know if you've recently gone back to using a hard drive-based Mac at any point, Bradley, but I've done it a couple of times recently, and it's one of those, how did we ever cope with those situations? It's absolutely astonishing how slow it is.
I actually have... done that this week because, like, I have a MacBook Air at work. My wife's computer is a 2009 MacBook Pro, and just the process of upgrading mine to Mavericks and hers, drastically slower on hers.
Hmm.
You know, like, yeah. I think mine started out estimated time 25 minutes, hers estimated time 50 minutes.
Yeah. Yeah, it is painful. And I think, you know, many of us have forgotten what it was like, but obviously we're not going to want to go back to that at any point, so... It's good that we've made the transition, but it's been tricky for those of us, like I think you and I are classic examples of people who have quite a lot of data, but not enough that we had to have very elaborate offboard storage solutions before. And I think what we've had to do is kind of invent a little bit of that over the past couple of years, and give another 5 years, we won't have to do that again anymore. And we'll all be rocking 2 terabytes of SSD in our devices. You know, maybe that's more than 5 years away, but you get the point that, I mean, my iTunes library setup now is so elaborate just to get all my videos off of my MacBook Air, which I never had to do before when I had a 1 terabyte iMac, because I had all that storage there. So it's been a good transition to do. It's one of those things you've just got to do, otherwise it'll never be done. So here's to the future of multi-terabyte SSDs in entry-level models.
Yes.
I'll drink to that. So yeah, I think maybe next week, Bradley, we'll talk a little bit more once we've got some more time under our belts with about the new iWork and iLife software. I think my kind of feeling right now is that I had hoped for a little bit more with such a big upgrade, but I think obviously what we're seeing is that some amazing amount of work must have had to be done to something under the hood to sort of justify all that time and effort spent without visibly dramatic different changes to the software. And I think maybe time will tell as to what exactly that was, because it's been quite surprising, a little bit disruptive. And hopefully, you know, the stories we're hearing about Pages and Keynote damaging files from older Mac versions is not as serious as it first appears. But we'll try and, I suppose early warning is good on that. We'll try and detail that in a bit more, a few more specifics on that in the next show.
Great. Yeah, sounds good.
Okay. Good stuff. So let's remind people where they can find us online.
Bradley Chambers on Twitter and chambersdaily.com on the web.
Okay, I'm Fraser Spears on Twitter and spears.org on the web. Catch you next week.